The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, Carabao Cup semi-final special. Late Egyptian joy at Villa Park, El Mahamadi to Trezeguet in injury time, and Dean Smith's men are on their way to Wembley, where they'll be soundly beaten by Manchester City, themselves beaten by their rivals who win at the Etihad again. So, are Manchester United good now, or should City have won both legs about 20-0? In arguably the most predictable result of the season in the Premier League, Liverpool win at West Ham. There's transfer news, Spurs doing some buying and selling, and there's transfer nonsense, which part of Richarlison to Barcelona for €100 million rejected by Everton is the most ridiculous. And of course, the biggest news of the week, the Colin Calderwood revolution is over at Cambridge United. We'll do all of that, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Mark Langdon is here.
Hi, Max.
Nice to see you. Ladies and gentlemen on the panel, Mr. Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
And ladies and gentlemen,
Lars Severson.
Lars, why did you...
It's a tough crowd in Dublin these
days. Why did you get such a terrible reaction?
I had no idea, and I don't know what you're talking about.
Come on, you can tell the story, or me or Barry will.
Well, I had a footballer moment, put it that way. You always get this thrown at you, especially if you've been on TalkSport, that, you know, why are you talking about football? You've never played the game at the highest level. And if nothing else, I've proved emphatically that I can be quite as daft as any footballer in my daily life by forgetting my passport when we were going to Dublin. So I had to go back, and there was no time to get my flight. So I got a later flight, which was then delayed.
And you missed the opening 15 minutes of our live show.
Yep.
And hearty gratitude to Dion Fanning for nobly stepping into the breach.
Who, let's be honest, was a significant upgrade.
He really was.
Well, you do say that, and I'm not going to contradict you.
Thank you, Dion. You're welcome on the pod anytime. And
I did get there, and it got better. So there was that.
True. Right, let's start. If you ever come, if we get you on a live show, Mark, if you could just get there 1 minute before it starts, that would be really, really greatly appreciated.
I mean, the frustration is the delay was not my fault, but the fact that I was on that plane was completely my fault. Mm. I can't really complain.
No, you can't.
So I'm just, complaining without complaining.
You're in the doghouse.
Yep. Did you give your fee a decent percentage of your fee to Dion Fanning?
I offered to do so in your presence. And
very quiet.
After he had left the building.
That was a bit like how I offered to pay the bill when I had lunch with the Glendennings. More of that later. Aston Villa 2, Leicester 1 then. That last minute winner from Trezeguet. I was going to call him David Trezeguet, not as a joke then. But Mark, I mean, football is about joy and celebrating sometimes. And that was a wonderful moment for Aston Villa, for Dean Smith and for the fans as well.
Yeah, it definitely was. And of course, you mentioned there Trezeguet. Of course, Aston Villa's Trezeguet is named after David Trezeguet, who scored that famous golden goal at Euro 2000. And then he scored sort of, Villa's, I suppose, not quite equivalent, but it was still it brought about a pitch invasion. And, you could see how much it did mean to Aston Villa to beat Leicester and to reach a final. I felt that they played their part in a really entertaining game. I mean, Leicester definitely over the two legs created more chances, but you would expect that Leicester are a better team than Aston Villa. But Villa still showed, I think, that they are, they're in what footballers sort of call a good moment, that they're doing okay in the Premier League just now, and now they've reached the final. And although Trezeguet was the kind of match winner, Grealish was the player that just stood out a million miles.
Yeah, I mean, a lot was made, Lars, of Jack Grealish versus James Maddison in a sort of phony war that isn't actually happening.
Yeah,
they're both not building armies together and meeting on a hill.
Don't really have to compare them, do we? I mean, they're two very good players.
They are.
But I do. I've always liked him, but I am fully on the Grealish bandwagon now. And he's one of those where I think it's a good idea to look at his numbers occasionally, because he looks a bit lightweight. He looked like he sort of faffs about a bit, but he wins the ball an awful lot. And he's one of those who looks like he might be a bit of a luxury player, but then if you look sort of past the visual impression, he actually pulls his weight defensively as well. Obviously, his passing game is tremendous, and he scores the odd goal, and he's really, really good, and I hope he gets a chance for England.
Would you put him in the England squad, Pat?
Jack Grealish, I'd certainly put him in the squad. I'm not sure if I'd put him in the team, but I mean, Gareth Southgate has so many options in that midfield. Some very good players aren't going to be in the England squad for the Euros, and I'm a big fan of Jack Grealish's as well, and I'm delighted for him and Dean Smith, because they're both Villa fans, you know, and to get, well, Grealish has played. What has he played? Has he played in the FA Cup final?
He played in the FA Cup final, you know, when they beat Liverpool in the semi-finals, wasn't it? Against Arsenal in the final, was it maybe? He certainly played in that semi-final win over Liverpool. He's played in playoff finals. He's he mentioned that in the post-match, that, you know, you must be delighted to be, you know, off to Wembley. And he then sort of reeled off all the times he played at Wembley while his hair was being pulled at the same time, which he didn't enjoy.
I mean, it's pullable hair. I don't want to get on a, you know, Flo got in lots of trouble for saying she didn't like Jack Grealish. I mean, I'm a huge fan of his. I think he's such a great footballer. That, for the first goal, I was trying to work out if he intended to play the ball from his right foot onto his left foot to put it in the air slightly for Matt Target. Am I giving him too much credit to even entertain that thought?
He's good. He's not that good, yeah. I don't think. But even before that goal, Target had a chance doing exactly the same, where Grealish played him in down the left-hand side, and it's the weight of pass just always feels right, at the particularly at the moment, for Jack Grealish. I think he can get into the England team. I was sort of having a look at that midfield, and you'd only say that Henderson is absolutely kind of nailed on. He'll probably go for Rice or Winks as the defensive midfielder, even though, you know, neither's playing particularly well. And then you've got maybe an Oxlade-Chamberlain or Barkley if he wants kind of an all-rounder in that three. But I would like to see, whether it's him, whether it's Maddison or Dele Alli, I would like to see kind of more of a natural number 10, somebody a bit more gifted technically in that midfield.
He's a guy who gets kicked around an awful lot, and he's someone who, I think, in English football, it's because the one way he wants to play football, it's easy to look at, brand him as a little bit flash and someone who's, you know, maybe fancies himself a bit because he has the bravery to sort of try difficult passes and try difficult things. But I think perhaps if there's one thing that I think we are getting better at it in this country, we could get even better at it, is nurturing players like that and building them up rather than trying to take them down all the time.
He certainly meant that pass for Samatta, who completely misjudged it. And, you know, had Leicester gone on to win, there could have been a good What's the Matter newspaper headlines, if they haven't been there already. The first Tanzanian player to sign for a Premier League club. How did he look?
I don't think it was a great debut, and I don't think maybe we should expect it to be, you know, that amazing. He's only just arrived at the club. I think what he offers maybe different to Wesley is he has got that pace to run in behind if Villa want to play sort of slightly differently. I'm not sure he holds the ball up necessarily as well as Wesley, but it was his debut. He'd just been thrown in, really, which is not ideal. I think he probably needs a little bit more time.
I was obviously very excited to see my compatriot Örjan Nyland play very well for Aston Villa, which he hasn't always done in his time there. And it's perhaps appropriate that he has this great moment in the cup, because he rose to prominence in Norway when he was young by a string of sort of heroic performances for a small town club, Hud, who were there, in, I believe, in the second tier in Norway. They're more of a third tier club. They're from a place called Ulsteinvik. I think there's about 5,000 people who live there. It's sort of a coastal town way up on the west coast, very much in the middle of nowhere. And they reached the Norwegian Cup final in large part thanks to some heroic stuff from Nyland. And they won the Cup final. Again, man of the match performance by Nyland, saved a penalty in the shootout. So the Cup really was how he made his name very much at home, and this is certainly how he's made an impact at Villa now.
Yeah, I mean, the save from Maddison was good. The save from Tielemans is sensational. If you were Dean Smith, would you pick him for the? Does that pick him for the final? Or because Pepe Reina, I think, was going to play if he hadn't had a knock.
It's a tough decision, isn't it? On the evidence of that performance, yeah, I would pick him. but Pepe Reina is more experienced. Pepe Reina is probably better. I don't know. It would be harsh to leave him out, but those are the difficult decisions managers have to make. And I would not be able to do that if I was a manager. It's the leaving people out that I would really struggle with.
James Maddison tweeting afterwards, the next day, look, fair play to Aston Villa for getting to the final. I'm not making any excuses, but how a Premier League referee, Mike Dean, watching this from multiple angles several times, comes to the conclusion that this isn't a penalty. So I presume he's talking about the VAR as well.
Yeah, Mike Dean was in real time. I don't know. In real time, I thought it was probably handball, and then with the replays, you could tell it definitely, I think, should have been given as handball. I mean, it just comes back to its interpretation, isn't it, of what is and what isn't. But I think more often than not, that gets given as handball.
Yeah, would have made a big difference. Anyway, Aston Villa have got to Wembley to the final, where they will play Manchester City, who lost at home to Manchester United again. That goal from Nemanja Matic, who was then sent off, which basically lost any chance really that United have of taking this to a penalty shootout. In both those games, you get the impression that City really could have been out of sight.
Well, they certainly should have been out of sight after the first leg, and I thought maybe their profligacy in front of goal was going to cost them and come back to bite them. They were the better team in the second leg. They lost, didn't lose by a sufficient amount to keep them out of the final, but Manchester United did have chances and had that free kick towards the end, which, who knows, Juan Matic probably should have taken it. I'm not sure why he didn't, but I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was unimpressed that he walked away from it and left it to the others. But yeah, City did just about enough in the end, but they could have been made to rue their wastefulness.
A lot is made about Solskjaer and tactics, and, you know, coming up against these geniuses and coming up against Guardiola, and, you know, he's done one at the Etihad twice now. Gail says, look, are you folks just going to bash United, or can they at least get some kudos for winning this previous game?
I was thinking about this all the way in, actually, about what to say about this game, because it did show some positives for Manchester United in that they won the game. I still think that had City taken any number of their chances, you know, David Silva passing when he was sort of the penalty spot with...
I really appreciated that attempt for an assist.
And there was there were other opportunities, but I think this is what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is good at. He's good at setting a team up to counter-attack. The problem is for Manchester United is that they don't get to do that very often, because they're Manchester United, and most of your cheap points come at home to, you know, the kind of bottom half teams where you need to have a different game plan. And I think he's shown, even before this kind of double header victory over City twice at the Etihad, that he can do it. He did it against Tottenham at Wembley. He's taken points off Liverpool. It's can he coach the team in a different manner, I think, that maybe will ultimately decide his fate. In terms of the tactics, I mean, he was bamboozled by what Pep Guardiola started with, and so was I, really. I mean, I'm glad I wasn't doing a match report on that game, because I'm not sure what formation you would have written down for City.
Would you 3-4-1-2?
I mean, I thought it was like a three box midfield four, and then a three, so it's almost like a 3-2-2-3, and they didn't have anybody playing at right back.
I've seen 3-2-4-1.
Right,
like
okay.
With the two in front of the three, and then the Sterling and Mahrez wide, with sort of Silva and De Bruyne in between them, and Aguero up front. I don't know. It was experimental. Into the sort of free jazz phase of the Pep Guardiola reign.
Producer Jonathan asked, was Mark describing a WM formation? Is that in inverting the pyramid, and I haven't got there yet? Yeah,
it certainly is.
It's pretty early in the book.
Actually, it's in inverting the pyramid, but I blanked it from my mind because, I did. Lars tried to play it out from the back, and I know we talk about playing it out from the back and if that a good idea or not, but it takes some bravery at least. I mean, it's interesting because it seems with those players, right, it's all about therefore being so technically good to take the ball in a tight space.
Yeah.
And you look at the defenders and the midfielders they've got, you think that's really brave with those players.
Yeah, for sure. And I think I'm on Team Langdon with this. I find it really hard to talk about this game because, yes, in a way, they did show some resilience. They were still in the tie towards the end of the game, which no one would have thought ahead of the match. But also, City could have been out of sight if they'd been more efficient. So it's another, I guess, competent performance in a big game from a team that gets a lot of criticism and a lot of justified criticism. But I'm not sure it teaches us anything new about them, to be honest.
Could I ask the England fans among us if you're concerned about Raheem Sterling's lack of form and accompanying lack of confidence going into the Euros? Because there was one stage during that game he got the ball, he was running towards goal, and Raheem Sterling, at his very best, would have just slotted it into the corner, but he kind of second-guessed himself, turned, didn't. Are you worried at all?
No, I'm not worried. Actually, I think it's interesting because, and I can't recall if he's missed a load of chances recently. I know he was scoring for fun earlier in the season, but he just leant back on that chance. He actually, I thought, was pretty composed and took enough touches to go. He basically had, you know, he got past the keeper and then he could have easily just scored that chance.
It's his worst drought in front of goal for 2.5 years now. So I am now worried. That is a slight concern. I felt the bigger error was actually his offside, the goal that he scored when he was offside for the De Bruyne one, where he actually looked too desperate to get. That was a really poor run. There was, you know what De Bruyne is going to do in that situation. You just don't need to be offside. The ball will always be, you know, delivered where it needs to go, and it did feel kind of that was slightly panicked. He's got a terrible record against Manchester United. I don't know if that played on his mind a little bit. There's still more than enough time though for Sterling to kind of play himself back into form, but he's certainly not the Raheem Sterling that sort of started the season.
I suppose the worry is if he isn't in form and Kane isn't in form, they are two players that will be picked if they're fit. You know, and then
Kane will be picked if he's half fit, and we saw how that worked to Spurs' detriment in the Champions League final last season.
On Manchester United and the way they played, Bruno Fernandes from Sporting Lisbon, the Ed Woodward master stroke, 55 million euros, add-ons could increase the overall cost to 80 million euros. Sporting got him from Sampdoria for 7.2 million in 2017, scored 64 in 137 for them. I've waxed lyrical on the two football matches I've seen him play in person. But is he the sort of midfielder who can make playing it out from the back better, or is he more advanced? What is he?
He's slightly more towards the front end of the pitch, but I think he's the sort of midfielder is the right term here. Because when you sign a player from a foreign league, and especially one where maybe the level isn't quite as high as here, I mean, his day-to-day life in Sporting is kind of like sort of thwacking the teams who have, you know, not the same resources as them and are inferior in many ways. When you bring them up to a tougher league, there will always be questions. But at least I think this signing is Man United at least trying to find an answer to the right questions. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, since he came in, one of his big concepts has been pace. I want quick players. Remember getting sort of Lingard and Martial and Rashford on the pitch at the same time, having them run, prioritising pace and mobility. But then if you end up with a midfield where no one's particularly good at playing the ball in behind, and the only guy who can really do that is Paul Pogba, and he's unavailable to you for most of the season, that's a bit bad. If you look at the United midfield, what they really lack is someone who can play good through balls and get the ball in behind to these quick guys, and they really like a goal threat. And those are the two things more than anything that Bruno Fernandes brings. He scored a bunch of goals at Sporting, as we know. Whether he can score that many for United, I'm not quite sure, but he's certainly a goal threat, and he's a guy who tries to play risky passes, tries to play the difficult ball. And I think that's what they miss more than anything in the midfield for United. So there's no guarantee that he'll make it and be a success, but I think he's at least an example of them trying to answer the right questions.
I think the fact that he kind of has been abroad before is a definite advantage. He kind of grew up, really, footballing terms, playing in Italy, you know, first of all in the lower leagues and then Udinese and Sampdoria. It's only my biggest doubt about Bruno Fernandes is more the fact that how few teams have been in for him. This is somebody that's forced his way into the Portugal team that's got Bernardo Silva and Cristiano Ronaldo among the goal threats. He's been at Sporting a while. There's been a lot of talk about teams. Oh, they're watching him. They're watching him. But you get that with all of the Portuguese players. Their agents are probably busier than most. And you know, it was only in the summer that Tottenham were kind of the only team other than Manchester United that were in for him. And it does make you wonder as to why, you know, maybe some of the others are not. Like, he's obviously, there's something about him that the kind of the elite clubs at the moment don't like. And I haven't seen it, but there must be something.
Since Neil Ashton, who was a correspondent at The Sun and was hosted Sunday Supplement, has gone to Old Trafford to be a PR man. There have been articles in the press saying how good Ed Woodward is from people that he knows, and including, you know, saying this Fernandez thing was a masterstroke of Ed Woodward. And obviously, to me, it seems sort of pretty, you know, you can join the dots quite easily and go, well, this obviously is some PR that he's got. But I don't know if anyone else out of our bubble would care about that or not.
I think they would. It's quite interesting, you know. If you're working in public relations, there should be some subtlety about what you're doing, you know. So, but Ed Woodward's PR team should be the 11 men on the pitch wearing Manchester United shirts. And the fact that he feels the need to get someone on board and pay them presumably a lot of money to buff his image, it's faintly ludicrous. And the complete lack of subtlety about which it's all been done is turning him into more of a laughing stock than he was before, really. Which, so in these early stages, it's backfired. Having said that, Neil must have some gumption for public relations, because he did get this job despite writing quite a coruscating piece about how bad a job Woodward was doing only last year. I mean, I have met Neil Ashton. I don't really know him. He seems like a decent bloke. I know a lot of his former colleagues speak very highly of him. But this is his first job in PR, and perhaps Ed Woodward should have gone with some more experience. But the very fact that he needs anyone at all...
Sorry, Barry. he's appointed Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as manager of Manchester United. I mean, there's previous here.
Yeah, that is fair enough.
On a more serious note, Ed Woodward's house was attacked on Tuesday night as a group of people wearing balaclavas filmed themselves, launching flares at it, posted it online with the caption, "Ed Woodward's going to die." He's become a target of abuse from some sections of the club's supporters. Clearly, Mark, that is an escalation too far, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know Neil Ashton. No idea whether he'll do a good job for Ed Woodward, but the United fans shouldn't sing he's going to die, and they shouldn't sort of let off fireworks into his, you know, in towards his property. I mean, that's, you know, just decent human behaviour to not do that.
Manchester United released a strongly worded statement, quote, "Anyone found guilty of a criminal offence or found to be trespassing on this property will be banned for life by the club, may face prosecution. Fans expressing opinion is one thing, criminal damage and intent to endanger life is another. There is simply no excuse for this." There was a bit of trouble after the game last night, the Etihad. From David Heitner's report, television footage showed a couple of City fans making aeroplane gestures at their United counterparts, a reference to the Munich air disaster, while seats were ripped up and thrown in the away enclosure after the full-time whistle. City said they'd look at the CCTV footage to identify the supporters guilty of the Munich taunts, and the managers of both clubs condemned the incidents.
The aeroplane gestures are out of order, but the fact that Manchester City fans are doing them to United fans is pretty ridiculous, considering Frank Swift, who played nearly 400 times for City, was one of the victims of the Munich air disaster.
In transfer news, window is closing tomorrow, isn't it? Marcus Rojo heading to Estudiantes in Argentina on loan. It hasn't happened yet, but Marcus's mum has confirmed it. On her Instagram, she says, "The day came you come home. How long I have been dreaming about this moment. Welcome to your home, to your place, in the arms of mummy that misses you so much. I wish you the best in your return to your dear Estudiantes. May God bless and enlighten you. I love you with my soul, mummy." Do you think if you moved back to Ireland, Barry, Mama Glendenning would write the same sort of post?
You met her on Wednesday. What do you think?
I think she'd be more understated, but I'd say Mama Glendenning is lovely. And you've always painted Papa Glendenning to be, you know, you to be a sort of chip off the old block. But Mr. Glendenning is a very jovial chap, conversationalist, upbeat, chatty, fun. So I don't know where Barry got his general demeanour from. And as I did say, it was a lovely time. Me and Barry's parents had a lovely time while Barry moved food around a plate like Kevin the teenager, and just looked into the sky and wanted it to be over.
Well, I was just quite stressed. In the space of about 12 hours, you met my parents and a friend who I've known since I was 12 years old. And just to emerge from that unscathed without you getting any dirt on me, I consider it a triumph.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with Liverpool's shock win at the London Stadium.
Bookmarked an article but never returned to read it? You're not alone. With The Guardian's Audio Long Reads podcast, you can listen to expert writing on a diverse range of issues whenever suits you. From immigration...
At each appeal, she was refused the right to stay in the country.
...to cult novelists.
He could not avoid writing murder on his list of options.
For long-form journalism without all the reading, listen to The Guardian's Audio Long Reads on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to part two of The Guardian Football Weekly. Thanks all of you that came to Dublin for those two shows. We got two in Scotland.
Just about.
Yes, thank you. Thank you to the audience who came on time, mm-hmm. and thank you for last for bothering to come. Mm-hmm. March the 9th, Glasgow University Debating Chambers. We now announce Philippe Auclair as the final guest. Me, Barry, Lars and Philippe. Few tickets left there for people who are umming and ahhing about whether to see William Shatner live or us. Philippe will do spoken word common people, a la Shatner, if that swings it. The 10th, we're at the Pleasance in Edinburgh, Lars and Ellis, that's sold out. 23rd of March, we're at Earth in Hackney. And 9th of April, back in Leeds. Lineups for those to be decided. Right, West Ham 0, Liverpool 2. I was trying to work out, Mark, if, you know, Liverpool's run is obviously sensational and we expect them to win every game, but... Is Liverpool winning quite easily at West Ham the most predictable of the entire season?
Yes, in some regards. I mean, West Ham used to maybe have this reputation as just every now and then being able to turn up and deliver a performance. I think more of those were at Upton Park when it could be quite hostile. But this was a very comfortable win. But we do... We're in danger, I think, of treating Liverpool's run a bit like we do when Messi scores another hat-trick or another two goals, where it's just taken for granted that they've gone away from home to a team that's struggling, but still one that is capable. You know, last season particularly, West Ham took points off a number of the big teams, and just winning easily without Mane felt like they had at least another two gears to go up if they needed to. And it's just an astonishing achievement to have reached this stage of the season and dropped 2 points. Mm.
They've beaten every other team in the division at least once, which is quite remarkable.
I was chatting to Jonathan before the show about you can either watch the rest of the season and kind of be bored by how good Liverpool are, or try and engage with quite what they are achieving as a sort of one-off season, unless they manage to do this again and again, and say what they are doing right now is so extraordinary, and we should appreciate this for what it is and probably hope it doesn't come back every year, right, because we want close title races. But just to be doing this again and again and again,
well, I don't think it will happen every year, and it's not a one-off because they pretty much did it last season as well. It just Manchester City did it slightly better. But I just really enjoy watching them play, and I'm not going to overthink it. It's a brilliant achievement, but you know, those kind of achievements, you tend not to truly appreciate them until some time has passed and you're sort of looking back misty-eyed. But certainly for Liverpool fans, they at the moment, all they want to do is get over the line. Like, just get over the line, get it won, and then they can, they will be very understated in their celebrations.
It was a soft penalty, but probably a penalty.
Oh, I thought it was a definite penalty.
Okay, all right.
Sorry, Max.
No. I just, when I saw the replay again, I thought, oh, wait, he was sort of slightly tugged. And I suppose,
he was tripped as well. I thought it was a penalty.
And a second from a West Ham corner with some really fun bouncy, some missed headers, and then just a lovely ball from Mo Salah, and the Ox finished it off. Joe says after the Ox's goal last night...
It made it sound slightly sort of... morally dubious. Slightly fun bouncy.
I don't know what you call it, Lars.
Strange.
The West Ham players...
What happened on this corner, Max?
The West Ham players seem to be sort of trying to run in tar while, you know, the Ox wasn't. He was just going at a different frame speed to them.
Mm. Joe says, have Liverpool scored more goals from opposition corners than their opposition? I mean, it's quite possible, isn't it? On that beating every other team in the league thing, it's only happened 13 times stretching back to 1888-89, but now four times in the last three seasons. So I suppose it is a sign, isn't it, of the disparity between the big and the little.
What I think is also uncommon is that Liverpool have more than twice as many points as the team that's fifth.
Bill Edgar's stat, the Championship's bottom club, Luton, are 5 points closer to the top of the table than fifth place Man United are to the top of the Premier League.
I think I'm right in saying the last time they conceded a first half goal was in the Premier League was maybe Everton. They've been like 1-0 up in their last seven or eight matches. It's because even when West Ham did manage to, you know, get past the Liverpool press and then past at the midfield and then past Van Dijk, they've then got to beat Alisson, who made one really good save and has just been brilliant for them. And even when, you know, everything can still go right for Liverpool when Alexander-Arnold volleys a ball back off the post.
Where it's just playing out from the back, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's too easy.
Alisson catches the ball more than most goalkeepers. You know, I sort of don't notice it, but like just shots that other keepers might parry, he just catches it.
Yeah, I mean, there was when him and Ederson were both playing really well, when Alisson came over, there was this debate, in particularly in this country, as, you know, maybe Ederson should be the Brazil's goalkeeper. But I think Alisson has shown over the last 18 months or so, Ederson's a fine goalkeeper, but Alisson's just on a different level to just about everyone else.
The last time Liverpool were trailing in a league match was the 2nd of November against Aston Villa. Fun game time, everybody. Elliot says, where will Liverpool...
Fun bounty.
Fun, just a fun game. Elliot says, where will Liverpool drop their next point? Stop me when you think it'll happen. Southampton at home. Norwich away. West Ham at home. Watford away. Mm. Okay, if they haven't dropped a point by this, they'll have more points than Leicester did when they won the league. Bournemouth at home. Everton away.
I'll go Everton away.
Oh, okay. Palace home. City away.
Yep.
I did a at Watford away.
You did do a at Watford.
I do wonder if the Nigel Pearson low block revolution could maybe be a spanner in the works. I don't know. Because their lead is now so great, there's no feasible way of them throwing it away. It would be strange if we didn't see quite significant rotation in conjunction with the Champions League games. And there, surely...
Yeah, I mean, it's up to what the team that Klopp picks, I guess, doesn't it? Good news, though, for West Ham. Premier Inn hotels have, in a survey, have announced that they are the best match day experience. I know, it's amazing, isn't it? Magical match days.
What?
For
whom?
Each year, they say 20 teams battle it out in England's top tier in the Premier League with another 72 teams. Currently 71. Sorry, Bury fans. Well, I mean, it's just the most tone-deaf thing that's ever been written. Making up the English Football League, comprising the Championship, League One and League Two. But what makes an amazing match day experience? So they've ranked each team's stadium, but it's so badly done because capacity of ground is one of the factors, right? So anyway, West Ham come out top in the Premier League with Arsenal, Leicester, Saints and Spurs. Cardiff win the Championship. Sunderland win League One. And Bradford City win League Two. Monday night's FA Cup game, Arsenal beat Bournemouth 2-1. Should Arsenal go for this, Mark? They should, shouldn't they?
Oh, absolutely. You know, they're not going to finish in the top four this season. Their sort of campaign will rest on the Europa League success and FA Cup. And I think we saw, it wasn't a full strength Arsenal side, but I don't think it really needed to be against Bournemouth. What we did see, I think, from Arsenal was a good first half performance again. They do struggle to put it all together for 90 minutes under Arteta at the moment, but it is coming. You feel like there is progress and a future in what he is trying to do with that team. It just made me laugh the last sort of 5 or 10 minutes when Bournemouth were pushing for an equaliser, and I was thinking, surely Eddie Howe doesn't want a replay here. I mean, like, you know, of all the... I mean, yeah, sure, if you win, that's great. But a replay in the sort of, you know, in the situation they're in would have felt very odd. But they did push and they were maybe slightly unfortunate towards the end.
Saka's goal was, you know, if we ever needed proof that you can be beaten at your near post and it's not your fault, I think Saka, who hit that so hard from about a yard, they were meant to play 8 minutes of stoppage time and ended up playing just over 10. So, as Jonathan says, a nice rare outing of the five-digit game time. It's nice to see, isn't it? So Arsenal go to Portsmouth in the fifth round proper. Bit of football league for you. Leeds burnout has burnt out in style. 2-0 down at home to Millwall. They scored three in the second half. Two for Patrick Bamford to turn it around and go back to the top over West Brom, who lost at Cardiff. A big win in the chasing pack for Nottingham Forest. 1-0 in a six-pointer at Brentford. They're up to third. Wayne Rooney scored for Derby. They went down 3-2 at bottom side Luton, however. In League One, Rotherham and Wickham are joint top. The Millers overtook Ipswich with a 1-0 win over them, while Wickham beat Blackpool. Sunderland, Barry, you're fifth.
Another win, and the people, including me, who thought the appointment of Phil Parkinson as their manager was a hideous mistake, are being made to look quite daft now. But you know, long may it continue.
They've got a really big game on Saturday, haven't they? I'm going to Fratton Park, the Portsmouth versus Sunderland too.
Which is the playoffs last year.
Yeah, I mean, two of the real sort of big dogs in that division, both in form, but it's really congested at the top. Can't wait for it, actually.
Sunderland beat Tranmere on Wednesday night. Tranmere third bottom on a terrible run. Just one win in 11. 6 points from safety now. Remember, only three go down. With Bolton's massive points deduction, Southend's terrible season, really only one goes down, and Tranmere are sort of getting adrift in that spot. Bristol Rovers scored their first goal of 2020, but then allowed Bolton to equalise and win their first point of the year. So everyone's happy. The top two in League Two both lost, but remain the top two. But the big news from there is the end of the Colin Calderwood revolution. Christoph says, what will you wear, Max, on the touchline at Cambridge? Arsenal-style big coat, Southgate M&S suit, Klopp tracksuit. Michael said, who is tipped to replace you, Max, for the 8 or 9 months when you leave the pod to be Cambridge boss, alienate the fan base and then unceremoniously sack to make your triumphant return to Football Weekly?
Who is a shorter price to be Cambridge's next manager? You, one half of Groove Armada, or Mark Saggers?
Well, I'm the only one on the official board. Okay. I'm 100-1. Unfortunately, it's sort of 25 bar and then me. I was looking for, you know, was Kerbishley the same as me? Because that would be quite the blow for them.
So what do you think is the most or least likely thing to happen? Everton to finish in the top four.
Yeah.
Timo Pukki to win the Golden Boot, be top scorer of the season. Or you to be the next manager of Cambridge.
What's the least likely?
Yeah.
I would turn it down.
Because I'm just saying these are priced the same with the bookies.
Is that right?
Which is a diss at Everton, because Everton are just 10 points off the top four at the moment. They've got 10 points to make up, and they're priced the same to make it as you to be the manager of Cambridge.
Well, I had fun yesterday on Twitter, you know, building my backroom team. Wilson is in as director of football, Barry fitness coach.
I've already resigned. Yeah.
Lars and Langham together as nutritionists.
So what are you saying? I'm not getting travel secretary.
Lars, you can do breakfast. I'll do dinner.
Leftovers at all times.
Some interesting names in the frame, but I will not be. I just imagine having to go to every match.
It'd be awful.
Terrible, wouldn't it?
Well, you could do like Jurgen Klopp and just pick and choose whichever ones you want to go to.
Finally, a word about Billy Key, striker most recently with Accrington Stanleys, retired from the game at 29. He's not played since last April. He was given time off by the manager, John Coleman, to seek treatment for mental health issues, which he named as anxiety, depression and bulimia. After the summer, the club released a statement to explain that his situation had deteriorated, that he was undergoing specialist treatment and he was unable to return to play football. In yesterday's announcement, Key said, the most important thing is my health, my family, my wife Lee and two sons. And now I've made the decision, I feel in a better place. Accrington will always have a place in my heart. I can never thank owner Andy Holt, manager John Coleman and assistant manager Jimmy Bell enough for everything they've done for me. One of the best tributes came to him from Luton Town, who tweeted, the biggest compliment we can pay you, Billy, is that we hated playing against you. Incredible bravery to speak out about the issues you've faced and have no doubt helped many in seeking help. Good luck in all that you do in the future. He'll say his goodbyes on the pitch at their home game against Wimbledon on Saturday. And that'll do for part two. We'll start part three with the WSL Cup. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. The WSL Cup final will be between second and third in the WSL, Arsenal and Chelsea. Viviana Miedema scored her first goal in five, ending the drought. That is a massive drought for her. And Daniel van der Donk got the other as they beat leaders Man City 2-1. Norwegian Maren Mjelde, did I get that right?
She's very good, Maren Mjelde.
Yes, got the only goal of the game in the other semi as Chelsea beat Manchester United. Sad news from Bristol City. They confirmed this morning that both Megan Sargent and Elise Hughes suffered ACL injuries in their defeat to Liverpool. We wish them a swift recovery. Ada Hegerberg did her ACL recently as well, last, didn't she?
Yes, very sadly for her. Obviously, huge name in the women's game, amazing player. She has said she's determined to come back stronger than ever, and that the best is yet to come. And knowing just how fiercely driven and single-minded she is, I'm sure that's true. But it is worrying that this seems to happen a lot.
Yeah, let me just point you in the direction of Susie Rack. She wrote a really interesting piece about how female footballers are more likely to suffer ACL injuries and what the WSL and what physios are doing to try and mitigate that. The transfer window, everybody, slams shut again tomorrow night. Spurs have been quite busy, haven't they? They've signed Netherlands forward Steven Bergwijn for $27 million from PSV Eindhoven. He's 22, 31 goals in 149 games, won three league titles, nine caps for the Netherlands. Lars, what does he do? How good is he?
Bergwijn. He's a sort of a nippy winger. He dribbles, he can go past people. I think what's promising with him is that he's got an end product as well. I mean, not just in terms of he's got a good number of goals and assists, but his key passes stats look very good, which means there is often something that comes off his involvement. I think for me this seems like Tottenham going a little bit back to what they used to do, which is sign these sort of players who are on the up, look for value, acknowledging that they're not a club who are in a financial position to sign ready-made superstars. So you try to look around the continent and see if you can pick them up, players who are on the verge, who look like they're developing in that direction. And I think that's a smart way for them to go.
Lo Celso signed permanently as well.
Speaking of which.
Yeah, but you know, nippy wingers that can beat men. I mean, they seem to have quite a few of them.
Do they though?
They've only got Lucas and Son, I think, that can do that. And if, you know, I think Pochettino wanted to play with quite a narrow midfield. He'd accumulated quite a lot of central midfielders. But if Mourinho wants to play some kind of 4-3-3 or 4-2-3-1, you need more than two wingers. And I think that Tottenham have been looking for a left-sided winger as well. If you think that Memphis Depay is one that they definitely looked at, was too expensive.
Isn't Sessegnon meant to be that? I mean, he says he's been playing left-back.
Or a left-back, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure that everybody's massively convinced by Sessegnon. I think there's a bit of a punt being taken because he's gone backwards since that kind of breakout season for Fulham. But Zaha was another one. So I think even before Mourinho arrived, Tottenham were after a winger that could sort of go past people.
And I think the strike against Mourinho for a while has been that his teams don't like have fully fleshed out sort of attacking patterns, and he leaves it a little bit up to the individuals to find solutions in attack. And if that's the way you're going to go, you want individuals who can create imbalance on their own. I wonder if we're mispronouncing his name though. I think it's one of those consensus Dutch. I think the G, it turns into a sort of guttural sound.
Well, he went onto Twitter and said there are two ways of saying it, a Dutch way and an English way.
Oh, so you're allowed to do the English
one.
Can you give me at least one of the right ones?
I think
in Dutch it's more like Bergwijn.
Yes, yeah, but I think he was...
I was okay, was I? Okay, good. Rumours of Olivier Giroud to Spurs, that's who they're after.
I like that. Do the full William Gallas.
Would Chelsea sell him to rivals for a Champions League place? It would seem odd, but who knows? Lampard clearly doesn't rate him. I'd think he'd be pretty good signing for anyone.
Be nice if, but you know, because after the eyes of Llorente had gone, be nice to get.
He's a very handsome,
piercing
man.
Eyes in there. Danny Rose to Newcastle on loan till the end of the season. He's wanted to get away for a long time. Kyle Walker-Peters to Southampton on loan from Spurs. Edward says, can someone on the pod please explain why Spurs, who are currently short on players, especially at fullback, have just let two fullbacks go out on loan?
Well, the aforementioned Sessegnon has been playing left back. Vertonghen can play as a kind of narrow left back. Ben Davis is soon to return at left back and has been mentioned by Jose Mourinho as a very important player for his system. And Tanganga can play right and left back. So.
I wonder, but Danny Rose was one of those you thought, obviously his situation at the club we all know about, he's not been super happy there for a while, but I kind of thought he was one of the guys who Mourinho might, you know, get on side when he came in. Mourinho, yeah, he's a bit of a disciplinarian and he likes people, but he seems to get on with players. Throughout Mourinho's career, the guys who have done really well under him are people who have a bit of aggression maybe about them, people who, if you push them, they'll not just push back, they'll probably punch you in the face. And like, Danny Rose is a strong-minded guy, you know. I always imagined that was a match that could work.
Well, there's been a suggestion that one player was unhappy at the club and was maybe, that there were stories coming out that, you know, training wasn't great, and Toby Alderweireld said, you know, that's maybe some player that's not happy at the club. I don't know, we'll have to Google it.
It's interesting for him as a player because his journey has been interesting. You know, he was in that car, sure. You know, he was trying to get to Watford at the last game. You're like, why are you going from Spurs to Watford when 2 years ago you were trying to get to City or United?
Yeah, I guess part of that, and this might be misguided, but he's 29 now, and for a sort of flying left wing back whose game is a lot about the physicality, I suspect maybe some of the bigger clubs will look at it and say, like, at 29, is that where we want to go? But I'm quite excited about seeing him play for Newcastle in the system they play. I think that could work.
Speaking of Southampton, who are getting Kyle Walker-Peters, they're sending Cedric to Arsenal on loan, or Arsenal are taking him on loan. Arsenal have also signed centre-back Pablo Mari on loan from Flamengo with an option to buy in the summer. 26, Spanish, was on City's books from 2016 to 2019, but never played for a club, but that's where Arteta knows him from. James has a question. What would Barry turn down £85 million for? This is off the back of Everton, apparently turning down £85 million, €100 million for Richarlison from Barcelona. Joe says, is it simply the case that Everton don't trust themselves not to waste £85 million? But it just doesn't ring true. It doesn't ring true to me, this.
Well, when Everton paid, what was it, £45 million for Richarlison, we were all laughing. Has he justified the price tag? Probably not. He's shown flashes of excellence, but is he consistently good? No. Is he worth £85 million? No. Have Barcelona bid that for him? I don't know.
Have Barcelona got the money to do that?
I doubt that.
That's the other thing. Barcelona are not in a great place financially, and it seems odd because there's been this interest from them in Rodrigo of Valencia, but apparently the price tag has been a big problem, and the price tag is significantly less than what's been quoted for Richarlison now. It seems very weird that... it seems very odd, put it that way. That's all. I'm going to leave it there.
Reports that Barcelona are now looking at Willian as well. I mean, is it just it's deadline day, say some stuff about Barcelona, because
the one thing Barcelona don't really need at the moment, I would have thought, is a wide player. But Willian has been linked with Barcelona almost as much as what Gaetan used to be linked with Manchester United, you know, or Damião at Tottenham. Is it's very strange. I mean, there's nowhere really for Willian to play in that Barcelona team, I wouldn't have thought.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but Willian hasn't signed a new contract, has he?
No.
So he's on his last 6 months.
So maybe there's some agents getting busy.
Anyway, it'll be lots of fun watching relentless hours of transfer deadline tomorrow. Enjoy it wherever you are. Some fixtures this weekend, a couple of big games. Barry, Leicester, Chelsea on Saturday, Spurs, City on Sunday. Which of those are you most excited about?
I would be equally enthused about both, to be honest. Potential to be good games, and yeah.
Good.
I'm excited about Palace Sheffield United because it might become a bit soon, but it could be seeing a tall Norwegian man, Sander Berge, play for Sheffield United.
Who is this person?
Well, he's a midfielder who Sheffield United are very, very close to signing, might indeed have signed when this comes out. It seems to be very close to going over the line. He played from Genk in Belgium, a very tall midfielder, very highly rated around Europe. And I believe he turned down Sheffield United in the summer, but maybe having seen that they've done quite a lot better in the league than anyone had imagined, maybe it's seen as a more viable move for him now. A bit of a coup for Sheffield United, I think, if this comes off. Very interesting.
Manchester United Wolves is the late game on Saturday. They are tied on 34 points both, just six behind Chelsea in the race for fourth place. So a huge game for each of their Champions League ambitions. Bournemouth Villa, that is a massive six-pointer, isn't it? And
I mean, mentioned it at the top, Villa are playing quite well at the moment, and probably go to Dean Court believing they can get at least a draw. And Bournemouth,
they had that win though, didn't they?
They had the win, but they were still absolutely battered on the stats. And Brighton had 8 shots on target, which is not really a way of sort of showing you're controlling a match. It just means that you kind of won out of randomness more than anything.
Liverpool play Southampton. Danny Ings return to Anfield. Hasenhüttl has got them playing pretty well. We all were silent at the could Southampton take the points off, but you never know, eh? Newcastle, Norwich, Watford, Everton, West Ham, Brighton, and Burnley, Arsenal is the early kickoff.
Well, the West Ham Brighton game is huge, huge game. But they both need the points, and if West Ham lose or don't get all three, they have a hideous run of fixtures coming up after their next 7 or 8 games are all, apart from this one, are all against teams in the, I think, top 7 or 8.
Yeah, even after they do City and Liverpool, yeah, it's still hard. Know,
Spurs, Chelsea, yeah, blah, blah, blah.
In the French Cup, Mark, fourth tier Epinal beat Champions League Lille.
They did. I always think, though, with the French sort of amateurs and the lower leagues, you get a lot of shocks. And we've seen over the last sort of, I suppose, 20 years or so, I would say more shocks in that competition than in, say, the FA Cup. I don't know if it's because the standard is higher in sort of the lower leagues of French football, or if the in sort of the top league the standards are below. But you it's not, it doesn't feel like as, say, as amazing an achievement as what it would be if, say, a League Two team did it.
It's a very lazy observation on my part, but whenever I see these French Cup games against lower league teams, I'm taken aback by how good they look physically, the lower league teams. You look, these are some really, really fit guys, and amateurs in many cases, and compared to when I watch football from my own country, you see professionals who don't look like they're in amazing nick. So, I don't know, maybe they just look after themselves very well.
Inter beat Fiorentina last night. They finished the game with Victor Moses, Ashley Young and Christian Eriksen all on the pitch. And Eriksen came on in the 66th minute, and Inter scored the winner in the 67th. So he hoped it was, you know, his first touch in Italian football was a beautiful free kick. But, Mark?
Well, his first delivery in the Inter shirt. Tottenham fans won't be surprised to know it was a free kick that was cleared at the near post.
Did anyone see Daniel De Rossi being put in? Whose stomach was that?
Sorry.
So if you don't eat breakfast, oh, you did eat breakfast, didn't you?
Yeah,
not enough.
Okay, maybe just hungry for lunch now.
Yes.
Okay, it's not long to go. Anyway, did anyone see Daniel De Rossi join the ultras in disguise? Did anybody see this?
I saw you sort of put it around in the WhatsApp group, but I hadn't seen it before that, and very impressive.
It was sort of like one of those Ant and Dec shows, you know, when they spend ages being put in makeup to look completely different. And he looked like a very old man with a big wart on his face. But like, good for him to see how it all was. Bennett says, lesser question, but in Ottawa, we recently got news that Atletico Madrid will be purchasing an expansion team for the fledgling Canadian Premier League to play this coming season, which is super cool, he says. I've been furiously Googling their Spanish chants. So yeah, they've bought a team in Ottawa. They'll become the Professional League's 8th team when the CPL's second season begins in April. How do we feel about clubs buying other clubs over? I mean, this is not a new thing, is it? You know, City have got their team in Australia and in the States. And
I don't massively like it. I have to say, I think it serves a purpose, I suppose, in that you can get around work permit issues, and you can park players in certain places, and, you know, make them get better. I'm not a huge fan of it, but I can only see it going sort of more towards that way, where these richer clubs end up owning more and more elsewhere.
In other Canada news, Christine Sinclair has become the top goal scorer of all time across the men's and women's international game. 185 goals. Well done. And in more Canada news, having not really mentioned Canada, I think, at all in the 3 years or whatever that I've been here.
We did riff on Nova Scotia FC, didn't we, or Halifax?
We must have spoken about Alphonso Davies at some point.
Potentially. It's not, you know, we don't often cross to Canada, but, you know, hello to our Canadian listeners. The best thing from Canada is goalkeeper Nico Giansopoulos, who you can be seen, it's all over social media, I tweeted out this morning, He's a goalkeeper who plays for Calvary FC in Calgary. Although the footage, it's hot and sunny, and the commentators are Australian, so I don't quite understand it. But he has said, for everyone asking, yes, this is me, but before you judge, remember it worked. His team have conceded a penalty, the ball's on the spot, and he's taken shithousery to a new level by basically just taking a goal kick with the ball and lumping it upfield, getting booked, and then saving the penalty. David Squires, who alerted me to this, and we were saying, how is this not in Australia? And he said, maybe it is the Canadian Premier League's game 39 played in suburban Melbourne.
He did formerly play for a team in the National Premier League's Tasmania. Oh. I mean, maybe that is where he's from. I love that defence. Before you judge me, it worked.
Yeah, and also
that applies to a lot in football, I think.
The Aussie commentator calling a yellow card a big piece of cheese. he's got a big piece of cheese. Across Europe, more widely, big weekend. Madrid derby on Saturday. You've got Ajax PSV as well. First v third in the Bundesliga as RB Leipzig play Mönchengladbach. Hello to Alex Lowe, the guy who was sent off for two yellows in 10 seconds last week. He says, I appreciate the mention on Football Weekly. having watched the video back numerous times, I have to agree, two slightly suspect tackles, he says. Finally, a question for you, Mark, from Michael. Mark crashes on a desert island. There's an abundance of fruit, scores of fresh vegetables, but no wild animals, and the sea seems empty of fish. However, there are bodies of his fellow passengers. How soon is cannibalism an option?
I mean, what sort of desert island has got no wild animals nor fish?
The one you're on. I mean, look, you can't complain about it.
I mean,
the way the environment's going, you know, most of them quite soon.
I'll just go the way the other passengers and just die peacefully.
That survival instinct, there's one thing, there's surviving, and then there's
Castaway with Mark Langdon, very short film. gruesome.
I could eat this pineapple, but I'm just going to die instead. thanks so much. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
I hope that doesn't happen to you for obvious reasons. Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks for being on time as well.
Nope.
Thank you, Barry.
Didn't need my passport. You're welcome. For the tube. It's fine.
And thank you to the Glenn Dennings for having you.
Great.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.